Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast with your hosts, Rich Harden and Howard Young.
All right, Howard Young, good evening. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Well, you know, a little road weary. We just got back from North Carolina delivering a puppy and hanging out with you guys for the evening and eating some delicious pizza and then driving back through a tornado. So, you know, it was fun. You know, we got back to Louisville and right as I hit here, the tornado was hit. So, you know, luckily no damage to our business or us. It was all good.
I swear you have the worst luck traveling of anybody I've ever met.
It is, you know, the last few trips have sucked for sure. Travel wise, the trips themselves are good when I get there or come home, but getting there has been rough.
Yeah. We've got another weird weather thing. It's been a super busy week. It's supposed to get super, well, for us, cold. I mean, it was in the low 80s today, and the high tomorrow is 62 and rain, and the high Saturday should be 45.
I hope it freezes for you guys. You know, you guys need a little bit of that. But we get that here, and you always seem to skirt it. So hope it gets cold.
Well, I think we've gone from air conditioning to heat to air conditioning at least three times this spring, which is unusual.
Cool. Well, hey, tonight's guest is really cool. You know, we got to meet him down in Georgia a few years ago, or I did, at the Georgia Canine Foundation seminar that we would do. And super nice guy. Really liked watching him work. Had a lot of good things to say. And everybody around him really, really liked being around him. So really, really cool dude.
I would agree. I think I first reached out to Michael because I saw him working on a table, a makeshift table that he had made. And I thought, man, that's got some real potential and value. And that was before anybody started making any of these. And I don't know whether you were in a barn or something, but I remember thinking that thing has got some possibilities.
Yeah, I still got that table. It's my outdoor table now. It's set up outdoor, and it's still lasting. It's holding on by a string, but it's there.
Nice.
So, Michael, tell us what you've been up to.
I've been working, man. Earlier in the year, I ruptured my Achilles tendon. I don't recommend it to anyone out there that's thinking about trying it out. Definitely recommend against that. But so I've had to shift a little bit. You know, I've always been for traveling for the seminars. I've been like a very hands-on type. You know, I can. Right. I'll explain something, and then if it's not going exactly how I would like it to go, I could throw the suit on and do it. So I think it's been kind of a blessing in disguise almost, you know, kind of forcing me to outside of that, being able to show and having to articulate things a little bit more effectively instead of just watch me do this.
That's funny. Well, Howard and I would both agree, because as you get older, you get broke. So here you go. What happens to you?
So are you guys telling me I can join the club?
Absolutely. Yes,
you're
sir.
Way too young to be joining the club. However, I can completely relate to that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, definitely. I see it, you know, and I think it's exercising different muscles now, you know, trying to really figure out ways to, again, articulate what we're trying to get across.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in our industry, it's, you know, in all industry, being an entrepreneur, it's always a marathon, not a sprint. And now you have to, you know, at 25, this was a much different conversation I would have. Now at 56, we're broken, and you got to fix things a little and put things in place a little different. So
yeah, it's funny. I saw Cameron Ford like right after I had the injury, and then probably a year before, he's like, hey Mike, you got to take it a little bit easy on the decoy work. You're getting a little bit older. So I messaged him. Actually, when I saw him, I was just like, hey, you gotta move over now, because I'm doing detection now. I don't know if you know this, but.
I don't know. He's probably a pretty big niche.
That's it. Well, the first question I have for you, Michael, is how did you get involved in dogs?
Kind of the typical story in that, like, you know, I grew up with dogs. My family had Springer Spaniels growing up, and I will, just like the average, you know, pet dog owner, although we have working line Springers, I didn't really know the difference between the two. I just thought that, hey, I have these really kind of psychotic pets that are running around in circles, and I was very obsessed with them from very early on, not really understanding what at all was going on. I just was drawn to them, you know. I went to school as I got older. I went to school, I played basketball. Surprisingly, an ankle injury ended my basketball career. And I really kind of dove into psychology. So I got a bachelor's in psychology, also got a degree in sociology and then criminology. And I went into actually like human behavioral therapy. I thought that, you know, I watched, you guys familiar with the show Criminal Minds by any chance?
Yeah, of course.
So that was pretty big when I was in school and I was watching it and I was like, oh man, like these FBI profilers is pretty, they get to fly around in private jets and catch serial killers. I was like, I'm pretty sure I could do that. Sounds like a good gig. Found out, obviously that's not what it's about. You don't get to fly around in a private jet. So I went into some behavioral therapy for dually diagnosed adults. So it was kind of in the education field in a sense. A lot of them were court ordered there and we were working on trying to reintegrate them back into society. So it was basically, I had a class of around 8 to 10 of them each day, and we would cycle through the groups. There was about 4 different groups and really trying, you know, different techniques, you know, operant techniques actually, to see if we could teach them life skills and give them some independence. That all the time, simultaneously while I was doing that, I was kind of working dogs as a hobby, you know, going to a French Ring Club in South Florida and working with a few people that I consider mentors, not knowing that there was even a career in dogs or that that was even possible. Long story long, that job didn't work out for me. One, it was pretty taxing. I didn't really have the skill set to be able to kind of compartmentalize from work and home. And, you know, it was pretty sad stuff that I would be dealing with every day. And it was weighing on me a lot. And the dogs were kind of like my solace from that. And I would be happy when I was working dogs. You know, I told my wife one day when I came home, no longer going to be doing this therapy stuff and I'm going to train dogs. So you can imagine she was very pleased when I told her that and kind of haven't looked back since.
She felt really secure, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, she was like, oh, for sure. You got
it. The good news is it appears to have worked out just fine.
Absolutely, because she jumped on board. Sure. Otherwise, it wouldn't have worked out.
Well, that's what happens when you have a good partner, right? You got to have a team, and your team's got to have your back. And sounds like she did, and things worked out well.
Absolutely. So then, yeah, I'm here with dogs now and absolutely obsessed and love it, man. I love it. I'm excited to talk to you guys as well. I'm a little bit selfish in these situations because I like to pick everyone's brain and get what I can get from it, you know? So.
Well, you know, you said you went to school in Florida and was working in Florida. So how did you end up in Canada?
So I'm originally from Canada, the Toronto area. So we ended up back, me and my wife moved back up here once we kind of started the business. We felt that there was a more open market, not so saturated as, you know, South Florida was with dog trainers at the time. And a lot of the agencies up here and still to this day, mainly go down to America to purchase their dogs from vendors. And I knew that I wanted to get into the police dog world, providing dogs, training police dogs. So I said, hey, my family's up there and there's kind of an open market. She reminds me every real good winter that, you know, we could have been in Florida.
I was going to say the weather is probably just a bit different up there.
Just a tad bit, you know, just a tad.
So you're pretty active on social media, and one of the things that we were tossing around is what could we talk about or what should we talk about? And obviously we could talk about a whole variety of things, but it just so happens that I saw a video that you had done and you were kind of poking at your wife a little bit about self-diagnosing symptoms and accessing Google and accessing WebMD. And it led into you actually did a nice segue into talking about how we live in an age of information and there's so much available to folks. And it's you called it choice paralysis, which is a great term because there's so many things that you little bits of this, little bit of that. And I want you to talk about that and we'll head down that path is because there are a lot of things in life that the model that someone may have developed is really, really good. And then people think they can do better by coming up with their own model, by taking bits and pieces of things. And honestly, what that ends up being is a high-end junkyard of parts and things that really don't meld together very well. So I think it's a great topic because I see people floundering, literally floundering, because they're going from place to place to place, learning, and they've never chosen a lane, and they've never really latched on to something, right, wrong, or indifferent. Just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that it's first and foremost, I need to give credit where it's due. That was my wife's idea. If I don't say it was, I'll be in the doghouse. But it was from a conversation that we had. You know, I think, like, to me, I haven't been in the dog world as long as you guys have. And there's big pendulum swings, you know, like there's these times where it's like, hey, this is the way to train dogs, and you stick to who your trainer is and you don't go outside the box. And I think if we go really far that way, that's also damaging.
I agree.
And I think if we go really far the other way, where it's, hey, there's all that information and we took, you know, 5% from this trainer and 5% from there, and you build it all up to 100% like that, then it's so scattered that there's no, you know, it's not really a system, and it can be just as damaging as well. So I don't think it's one way is right or one way is wrong. I think it's about finding that happy medium. And what I say to all of my trainers here, we have an apprenticeship program that we run, and I was like, hey, because there's so much information online and available and at these seminars, the first step that you need to understand, the first thing that you need to understand is how dogs learn, how to read dogs, what those behaviors are saying, understanding these learning theories, because then we can start to use that as a filter for the information. You know, there's really good information online, and then there's really crappy information online. I mean, if you don't have at least that basic kind of understanding, I feel like it's hard to filter through all. It's impossible to filter through it. So really understanding those principles go so far. And it's funny, because when we're making the post and coming up with the idea, it's kind of a little jab at myself as well, in that I'm so hungry for, I'm like, oh, Howard, how do you do your muzzle thing on the, when you put the muzzle on a fence? I'm going to try that. Or I seen this person, like, I'm that person with information, right? And I know that about myself, that I want to just take a piece from everyone and try and put it together. And if it's not working, I'm going to try it from a different angle and forcing it together. And it's like, like really almost a self reminder as well, to be like, hey, take a step back. It's, you know, that's a part of the system. That's not the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
Is that making sense?
Sure. Yeah, because I think, you know, when you're starting out as a trainer, you know, you need to niche yourself down a little bit. You need to go down a lane and get really good at that part of what you think you want to learn. And then as you learn things, you know, you'll say, oh, okay, provided the correct context, because that's, you know, the problem I have with social media all the time. And we've been down this road many times so far on this podcast, that someone will send me a video or Howard a video, and they'll want us to comment on the video. I'm like, well, is this the best rep the dog got today? And how did the dog get there? Mm-hmm. Then I can respond. You know, sometimes I might go, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, whatever you're doing, just don't do that. But I don't know where they've been and how they got to where they are. So it's hard to, you can comment all you want to, but it doesn't mean your comment is correct, because you don't have any context about where these folks came from. You know, how did you get where you are today? And if you know that, then maybe we can actually, you know, respond or help say, hey, you know, look, if you try this or that, and that's a big difference in the picture. But that's where social media gets in the way.
Yeah.
It becomes analysis paralysis.
Yeah, I 100% agree. There's all this information, but there's also so many parts of that picture that you're not seeing, right? So many parts that, like you mentioned, context, you know, and it goes again both ways, right? Like that context, maybe that the video looks really, really good, that video that we saw online, but we don't know that it was 150 shots to get that one video of that dog looking really good, right? Or again, the opposite. So I think that you get a small, you're just looking through like a little looking, it's like you take a toilet paper roll and you're just looking through that toilet paper roll, and all you get is that quick little picture, and you can't see the rest with the wide angle lens.
Right.
Really understand what's going on in that view. So I absolutely think that's one of the curses of social media. You know, I use social media and I post quite a bit on all the platforms that I'm on, because I try my best to share information. I try my best to say, hey, someone gave me this information, and I think that it helped me a lot, and I've tried it and I've worked it on not just one dog, but numerous dogs. And these are the results that I was able to come up with. But I never say that, hey, this is the way, or this is the best way. This is the way that one of the ways that I've came across finding a solution to this problem.
That is a much better perspective, for sure. Well, you know, you said something earlier, right, when you started about, you know, understanding how dogs learn. And, you know, we, every place Howard and I go, we start off with that very concept. And people are always say, well, you know, why do you always start there? I said, well, you have to know how dogs learn. And then along the way, what it helps you is I'm doing a rep. Is my dog at acquisition? Does my dog, is he just acquiring the skill? Does he have any fluency? Or can he even generalize what I've asked him to do? And if the answers to those questions are maybe, then, you know, you have to back up and punt a little bit. And yeah. Why do I put my dog in a position that he won't be able to understand what I'm asking of him? Because I don't understand where he is in the learning process.
Absolutely. And that, again, that's not to just reiterate what you're saying, but to do that exactly is, you know, I say to my trainers and like, hey, there's parts in behavior when we're first teaching behavior that's exactly what we're doing. We're teaching. The dog is trying to figure out what the right answer is. And it's my job as the teacher to get them to that answer. Then we get to a phase where we're training now. And once we're training, okay, the dog kind of has a pretty good understanding of this behavior. And once they really understand the behavior, and only once they understand the behavior, to me, is there an obligation? But I can't jump from, hey, you don't know what this behavior is, to immediately there's an obligation to the behavior that you don't understand.
Absolutely. Yeah, completely agree.
This episode of the Working Dog Depot podcast is brought to you by our title sponsor, Fox and Hound. Fox and Hound has spent years creating the perfect formulas that are safe for our pups and contain many natural ingredients. They develop the highest quality of products for all dogs and products for all dog lovers and their homes. Products range from scented candles to dog shampoo, flea and tick spray, stain remover, paw balm, and dog cologne. They've even developed a line for working dogs and their handlers. For you folks who are required to wear a vest while on duty, you should check out their vest spray. Folks, the Young Home has Fox and Hound products in every room. For me, it's really quite simple. The products are great, and they're made by great people. Order online at shopfoxandhound.com or follow an order on Instagram at shopfoxandhound. For a 15% discount, use the WDDP discount code. Remember, man's best friend deserves dog's best products.
What's really bizarre, just listening, I've been doing a lot of reflecting this week. We've had, and every time we have an episode like this, I do a lot of reflecting. And it's almost like a hell week this week, because I've got a group that I've been working with for about 2 years, not all of them have been 2 years. So we've added some dogs to their group, and they're getting ready to do a certification. And, you know, I'm looking back on the way that I've done things over the years, and I've changed my priorities a little bit. So I find myself in a situation where I've invested very heavily in making sure that they can function on the street and do all these things, I think, very well. And now we're in a situation where we're having to, you know, follow these regulations to the T in order to pass the certification. So the two don't hinder each other necessarily, but that's been my focus with these guys all week. So it's gone pretty well. I think I'm probably guilty now at this point of my life of investing more in the go, 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 go. Whereas when I started, I think it was much more heavily in obedience and control because that's what I knew. That was my experience. And then I think kind of let some of that go. And I'm kind of reminding myself, I said, hey, man, don't forget about that. You know, that's really important.
It's important.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel the pendulum swing that way a little bit. Like, I got to bring some of that back. So it's been an interesting week, but we've had some funny things happen. It's been good.
No, and to me, it's funny that you say that because, again, I haven't been in the industry super long, but I've seen the pendulum swing, right? Like, just maybe, you know, 3-4 years ago, it was all about just horsepower and go and do, you know, there's no need for outs and there's no, like, just all of that talk. And now the pendulum has swung to, hey, control is important. You guys need to have control. And I absolutely agree with that. I think that what's really cool is that as we get more information and across the board, people become more skilled, we start to realize that control, it particularly in man work, isn't a hindrance to power, right? Like, if anything, really good control in that work should build our power. We should have even more power. We should have even stronger behaviors, and with the right control and done the right way, it should be our invisible back tie. You know, that the dog gets to load up in, and So I think that that's really cool. And I'm blessed by being able to travel across kind of the world at this point, luckily, and seeing how dogs are used on different areas and being able to take information from over there and bring it to these guys over here and vice versa. So.
I remember a time where it was pretty much understood that if you were going to exact some control on dogs, particularly in the area of bite work, that you could expect the bite quality to diminish because of the conflict, but some of the corrections that were taking place. And it was really funny that these guys this week have said, hey, man, my dog's bite has actually gotten better this week. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's a win-win.
Yeah, it's that clarity, right? That clarity that's there, and it's they understand the behavior, and now there's obligation to the behavior. Mm. So if they understand it, and there's obligation, and there's clarity, obedience becomes better, right? Mm-hmm. Bite work becomes better. Detection becomes better. Their tracking becomes better once they work in conjunction.
Yeah, you can make it's a detection, people, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. I've been a big pet peeve of mine. Don't make my dog walk on a loose leash to go do a detection problem because you're going to diminish his drive. Oh, yeah. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, we hear that all the time. Like, no, pulling on the leash and gassing themselves before they even get to the problem doesn't diminish their drive, though, right?
No, not at all, right? That's exactly
we had some really good conversations about that. You know, if we're getting ready to work on some control issues too, don't let him walk in like a monkey and then expect him to be under control.
We talk about it all the time. It's, you know, you're setting a picture for a dog. So if you let the dog drag you into a scenario and then give it a bite while it's doing all the monkey stuff that they do, then the next time you come in to do something, you're going to have that exact same picture of the dog.
Right.
But absolutely. If you had nice control of your dog all the way up to the door and you healed the dog through the door and into the next room and all of a sudden magically he got a bite, well, is the control going to get better or is he going to become more crazy? The control is going to get better and the bite's going to be just as hard.
Yeah, he sees the control as his avenue to his bite. So his performance gets better, you know, like, hey, if I walk in this heel even better with more power and more precision, that's the criteria to get what I really want. And I think I'm starting to see it more and more when I travel that's kind of getting across the board to everyone. It's really cool to see, man. It's really cool to see, especially when they're not so sure of it and they try it out. And we, you know, a lot of the seminars, I only have them for a couple of days and then they try it out. And then we see those kind of that power and those biting mechanics change or the dog's tracking abilities increase, not based off of any of the tracking or bite training that we've done, but just applying some control with fair and clear communication to the dog. You know, the issue comes when it's the dog doesn't really understand and then handlers start, you know, aversively trying to control the dog. And if we raise these dogs that, hey, they're the toughest guys on the block and you try and whoop him, he's going to whoop you back if he doesn't understand what you're asking, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. These guys were sharing with me about another agency in their county and that they keep returning dogs because the handlers keep getting bitten. Well, at some point, you've got to come to some sort of a conclusion. It can't always be the dogs.
Yeah.
Because statistically, it doesn't add up.
That's right.
It's got to be the methods that they're using, the conflict that's being introduced into those relationships, which is really, it's really kind of sad, honestly.
Yeah. It's sad on the dog's behalf. It's, you know, unfortunately things like that, they, within a system that sometimes take a little bit long to change, right. Or to acknowledge. And I've seen it on my travels, but eventually, you know, at least the dog gets a bite out of it. So.
Definitely gets empowered. You have any trips in the near future?
Yes, I have quite a bit, actually. I have my club, actually, you know what, for the rest of until the last week of April I'm home, but then I'm back on the road. I got one I'm really excited about. We're going to Zimbabwe to work with some of the anti-poaching units out there. Yeah. That one's in November, but I'm counting down the days to that. So it'll be my first time working with them over there.
Very cool.
You are going to be in Pittsburgh at Hold the Line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I did a seminar with Joe. Me and Carlos did one with him, a decoy seminar, and I was giving him a hard time because he didn't invite me last year. So I was like, oh, now you want me to come.
Well you guys are getting center stage, so I would say he's gone beyond just inviting you.
But it's only because I bribed him. I said, well, since you didn't invite me last year, I better get something good.
We'll be there as well. It'll be good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's one.
The 6 to 8 slot on the closing day, PM. So everybody should be gone by then.
I'll be there.
Just kidding.
I'll be there. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. It'll be good to see you guys.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's circle back to the WebMD stuff that you talked about with your wife and dog training and how it can either benefit or, you know, degrade from what you're trying to accomplish. You know, so WebMD for me, you know, several years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer on a Friday afternoon. And the worst thing you do is you go home and you Google it, you know. So the type of cancer I had, well, then everybody pretty much dies. And so when you Google that, it becomes a really bad place because I had no context once again. You know, going back to my oncologist and learning a plan and finding out, hey, you know, this isn't as bad as what this looks like. So touch on that for us and let's try to help these guys that are searching, because we know we find, especially here like in Kentucky, we have a lot of small agencies that don't have access to trainers, and by no fault of their own. And I'm definitely not beating up any type of trainer that they may have there, but they don't have the experience or the know-how. And so they're searching and they're looking at all this stuff, and it's you go down a rabbit hole they just can't come back from.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like, what is the solution to that? Like what you just described, right? Like those people that are, and it's obviously not just isolated to Kentucky, right? Like it's here in Canada, it's throughout America, it's overseas. So to me, my one way of trying to combat that, and it may not be the answer, it's the only thing that I know how to do right now, is to put out information and try and give the best explanation that I can to that information. I think what's better than these little short clips that you see online is some of the longer form format. So podcasts like we're doing right now, I think that works extremely, because you get to hear people's full thoughts, and it's not just little sound bites to grab attention, right? You get to hear conversations. And so to me, longer form information online where there's maybe multiple people talking and a little bit of conversation and back and forth, also just understanding theoretically how dogs learn. And if it doesn't make sense from a theoretical standpoint, it's probably easier to X off of the list before you dive in anymore. Reaching out to people in the industry that seem like they kind of align with what training you have going on already right now. If it's 100% counter to what you're doing and you're having some success in what you're doing, then maybe try and find a trainer that kind of aligns with that a little bit. And to me, I've reached out to, I'll give you an example. I met down in Georgia, Pat Nolan, and it was like talking to a hot girl for the first time. Right. I walk up and I was like, hey, I'm Michael. And he's like, oh, the nicest guy ever. He's like, hey, I know who you are. I watch your videos. And I got giggly and I thought that I ruined my first impression, which I'm pretty sure I did. But I called my wife after. I was like, yeah, I just ruined it. He thinks I'm a weirdo. But anyway, like I got to sit down with him and just kind of pick his brain about information. And every trainer that to me is really good at what they do generally are very, it's very easy to reach them. And it's very easy to get, they don't try and hoard information and hide it from you. So if you have very particular questions, look for people that the industry says, hey, this guy knows what he's doing with this, not just, and go to them and ask them questions. 99% of the time they're willing to help.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think he's a phenomenal human being. He's agreed to be on this podcast and I just need to follow back up with him. Eric Stambro is the one that's the funniest. He said, every time I go to one of his talks, he said, I feel stupid. He doesn't make you feel that way. It's just that he's just got such an ease about the way he describes things, and he's still very passionate about what he does. And yeah,
yeah.
Pretty cool guy.
Yeah, I told you, I was sitting there and I was like, he's like, yeah, I watched some of your videos online. And I was just like a giggly schoolgirl. And he just, I was like, oh, totally ruined this. But well, super nice guy.
If we can, I would like to talk about something specific like outs. Because I really think that, especially since it's been my focus for a lot of the week, is that it's something that really plagues. And I know that our listeners, they, when they listen, they're not only do they gravitate toward the episodes of people that they know. And I know that this episode will be a popular one because you've established yourself as a real authority in this industry, Michael. I think you're doing a phenomenal job. People know.
Don't put that pressure on me.
Honestly. So I know that people are going to be listening for some how-tos, and that's really what they want. They want some how-tos. And I've seen some of your videos, and I think we do things probably very similarly, but I don't want to make some assumptions in terms of the initial trades for toys and starting with toys to begin to implement the out. And without, you go in as much detail as you want, honestly, if you want to lay out what your foundation for teaching the out is, if you don't mind doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the caveat to this is that the application changes based on the dog in front of me. I don't have a step one, I do this, step two, I do this. So it changes in that way. And sometimes I think the out particularly is something that can be a little bit misleading, or the information can be a little bit misleading online because it's so particular to a dog, right? So in the ideal world for me, I would like a dog, and we'll just describe absolutely ideal circumstances. I would like the dog's out to be classically conditioned reflexive response. In the ideal world, I want to be able to, when I say out, it's no different than a clicker going off or my terminal marker word. I want the dog to have an involuntary response and not just open its mouth, but let go and back up of what's in its mouth.
Right.
So how I get there is where it, or, and trust me, in an ideal world, it would be able to get there with every dog. I'm not able to get to that classically conditioned response with every dog.
No, I think that's important for people to hear.
Hey guys, I need to let you all know that the Thin Blue Line Conference is now the Hold the Line Canine Conference. It's the same great annual conference run by the same great folks. The Hold the Line Canine Conference is a 3-day educational conference started by Joe Lukowski, who is an active canine handler with the Pocono Mountain Regional Police Department. It was started solely for law enforcement officers and military personnel. This year, it will be held on May 2nd through the 4th in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They offer a variety of classes with an impressive instructor lineup, as well as an array of top-notch vendors. To ensure their attendees are up to date with the ins and outs of the canine industry, they are constantly making sure their class schedule reflects this. So new instructors this year include Kenny Williams with Interdiction, Mike Nesbeth, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Lilly, and Steve White, to name a few. Attendee and vendor registration is now open, as well as a variety of sponsorship opportunities. Don't miss out on this amazing opportunity to have a great time with fellow brothers and sisters in blue, as well as to further educate yourself to keep you and your canine safe. Register at thinblueline.conference.com or htlk9.com. Also, follow them on Facebook and Instagram for continuous conference updates.
Yeah, so, yeah, definitely. There's some dogs that we can do all of, we can have classically conditioned outs on items that are of less value, right? So maybe the dog doesn't like a tug as much as it likes a ball. So the tug, it will out more, and we could build a classically conditioned response. Then we can, my process is to try and go through steps in a hierarchy of reinforcement. So what do they like, but not as much as a bite? And work my way up that ladder. And sometimes I can get them classically conditioned, you know, all the way up until the bite, like an actual bite, or until the bite on a suit, they're classically conditioned, but an actual bite, they're not classically conditioned. Like we have to understand that these dogs are very individual creatures, and they're not that one shoe kind of fits all, one size fits all idea. So basically I try and trade them off for items or lower value items to them, the same item trade off until it's, I can anticipate it and it's a predictable behavior. Then I try and name that out only once they're predictably spitting it out. And then I just move up the ranks in the basis form of the ideal world is what I try to do. mm-hmm. some of the issues that we can run into, it goes both ways, right? Sometimes I can't classically condition the out, or sometimes these dogs are very sensitive to that type of things, and they anticipate the out before I want them to out. So it's, again, like everything, it's a pendulum and it's balance. In the beginning stage, I'm okay with them anticipating the out because we're in the teaching phase. I'm trying to let you learn what my expectations are of you. And eventually we get to the point of the obligation phase, then I don't want anticipations of the out, but I do want the dog to understand that there's an obligation to the behavior of outing and they need to do it when I say so. Does that kind of make sense what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yes, for sure.
How does that mesh kind of with what you guys do for outing? I would like to know. I told you I'm going to be selfish, so I want some info too.
I go back straight up. We just choke them. No, I'm just kidding. not really. It's the same thing. I try to find, you know, my dog doesn't have it. If he can't out a toy, how's he going to out something that he really feels is a reward? You know, that he really gets satisfaction. The answer is he can't. So it's just like, you know, downing a dog, you know, when you throw a ball and get him to down, will he stop before the bite? You know, right? If he can't do that, then he's going to continue with the bite. So exactly. It's pretty much the same process for me.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say the same. I think one of the very cruel things sometimes is that the work that we do on the table doesn't always translate very well or generalize well off of the table, and trying to find ways to make that work. I mean, sometimes it does. I mean, I could show you dogs that are pretty sticky on their outs, you know, in an engagement, engaging a decoy on the floor, look like an absolute rock star on a table. I mean, yeah. Spit out down, wait and anticipate for the next direction, and we don't always get that. But again, what we're able to do on that table is to isolate those behaviors, and we've got all this focus that's centrally located on everything we want, and there's only a certain degree of pressure that can be applied on that table. Yeah. But so what's your take?
I think something else that often goes overlooked when we're trying to get those outs and teach those outs is the actual decoy work, right? So much gets focused on the dog and the handler in those moments that I think that we underestimate the importance of a really good decoy to teach outs with. There's such small nuanced things. Like I tell my decoys when we're working on outs, even if we're on the table, hey, once we ask the dog to out, now that's your real estate there. So I don't want you to pull back away from them. I don't want them to when they open their mouth, I don't want you to just pull your arm out. No, you right. own the real estate here now. And the dog's job is it needs to open its mouth and back off of you, not just open its mouth. So then when I find that, like just that little small nuance of them staying there and owning that real estate makes it a little bit easier to transition to off the table to the ground.
Sure.
Because the dog now isn't just opening his mouth, but they're understand open and get off. Open and get off. Right. But again, it doesn't work like that for every dog. Sometimes we take them off the table.
The other little things too, I think by simply diverting your eyes, quit mm-hmm. eyeballing the dog as he's being told to out. He's just look away. Yeah. You don't need to watch him.
Yeah.
It can make a huge difference.
Absolutely.
But do you also think that, so you go from all that, right? We just talked about, and then you put the play in the real world, where now your excitement of the handler is way up. The dog's reading that, and they're on a real bike. You know, how do you teach a dog during those moments? Now, when the handler is way up and not being able to control himself because everybody's screaming and yelling, you know, because he's on a real bike, is that just training for the handler? Is that putting them in more real world scenarios to teach them how to be calm? You know, because we all know that when it's real, it's different, right? You know, gunfights and dog bites and all those things are way faster in the real world than they are in training.
Yeah, and as far as my real world experience goes, I'm a civilian and I don't try to play the part of like I'm the dress up soldier or the dress up cop. I'm really good I'm pretty good at the dog behavior stuff, and I can try and set up to include stressors on the handlers in those moments and include, but I've seen dogs, you know, a week after they have their first initial engagement sometimes. And that's a brand new dog that you're dealing with now, you know, like life has purpose for them. So I've seen dogs before and after, but I've never been the guy there with the dog in those moments. So I try to back off and leave that to the other people that deal with that. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Like,
yeah, I want the experts in there.
I feel myself in the same boat. I mean, I'm preparing guys to do the real thing. And occasionally we have situations. We've had them as recently as this week where they don't always go as planned. And some dogs just, whether it's a failure to engage, or most of the time it appears with our dogs, when it does happen, it appears to be more of a lack of understanding or confusion on the part of the dog rather than a lack of heart. I mean, so there are such, we basically had a guy that this week that did a, four guys jumped and ran. They were four people, and the dog, he'd never seen four people run from him like that before. And he was clearly confused. I think he hemmed one up on top of a car, and then he went, well, I can't get that one. So he ran after another one. I mean, it was, and he didn't engage any of them.
I think that is the perfect example of what we're talking about when we say choice paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the dog gave us a really good example of that. I think, yeah, there's definitely things that we can't prepare for, you know, so I think that it's, you have to take those moments and those times and say, hey, now back to the drawing board, and we're going to set this up to be better prepared for this in the future.
It's funny. That's exactly what we did the other night at training. Basically,
yeah.
Loaded two guys up. I couldn't get four, but I could get two that were willing to do it in a muzzle. And we did a small car chase. They jumped out of my van and took off. And I'll tell you what, the first one, the dog was confused. Second rep, he was on the money. He was getting it. He understood it.
Right.
So we're constantly making those kind of adjustments. And, you know, there are some dogs that seem to just really get it from the start. Then there are others that they just need some accommodations along the way to figure this thing out.
Yeah, I agree. But that, again, that one size fits all attitude isn't it. Because I'm sure there's other dogs. Yeah, like you said, we'll just figure that out immediately. It doesn't mean that the dog is not a good dog, or you need to. Sure. It just means, hey, if the reason why he failed on his deployment was confusion, then we have some work to do. That's all it means. That's
right.
Let's clarify.
I think that there's a ray of hope there.
If
that's what it is. And I think sometimes that's my role, is to help the handler understand is that all is not lost. This dog has the intestinal fortitude to do what he needs to do. He just doesn't understand his task.
Well, and I try, like when I have like green handlers with green dogs that haven't had engagements yet, obviously we first and foremost, it's not about engagements. It's about arrests and, you know, evidence and crime that's been stopped and prevented. So it's not just about those actual engagements. But when they're nervous about it, I was like, listen, you're that nervousness of whether your dog is going to do his job or not is going to be there. And this probably is going to make it better. But I know a ton of dogs that have had in multiple engagements, and then also had, after their multiple engagements, had failed engagements. So like it's not so much about, oh, once they've checked that box and now your work is done. Like that's not how it goes.
So,
you know, you need to be prepared as a handler, in my opinion, for what you should believe in your dog and trust he's going to do what he's going to do. But also, hey, you're a cop first. So like if things don't go.
So, you know, the upside of this situation is all four of those people were apprehended, you know, and it was a win at the end of the day. And the dog, I guess, in some fashion did assist. He just didn't do what we expected him or wanted him to do. But, you know, it wasn't all was not lost.
Well, Michael, you just said it, you know, first and foremost, that, you know, if you're a police officer or a military guy with a dog, you know, you're a soldier or a police officer first. And the dog is only an enhancement of what you do. It is not a replacement for anything you do, you know. And so we fail all the time as human beings.
Yeah.
And so to think that your dog is going to be 100% every single time, that is going into things in a big failure already.
Yeah. And understanding, you know, sometimes like absolutely, there are some dogs that are on the road and have failures that shouldn't be on the road. And by no means am I saying that those dogs should still be on the road. What I'm saying is that there are some failures that have occurred that aren't a dog problem.
Right.
Right. There's sometimes a failures occur because lack of clarity of task. I have a drill that I do that I am very highly likely, I can guarantee most dogs would fail. And it's not something that they would see on the street, but it deals with competing motivators, right? If I take a dog that has had the vast majority of its foundation on biting equipment, sleeves, suits, and so forth, and I put a suited decoy standing in a room, and then I put a guy sitting in a chair in his underwear with nothing on, and I have a muzzle on the dog, and the dog's truly muzzle conditioned, and I say, hey, doggy, go after that suspect that's sitting in the chair without a suit on. The vast majority of the dogs in the room are going to go to the suited decoy.
Sure.
Right? And they would all, quote unquote, fail that exercise. Well, some of the dogs that are failing that exercise are act like rock stars on the street, but it's just a target acquisition drill, and they're not understanding. And obviously they're not going to see a guy on, knock on wood, who knows? They're not going to see a guy with a bite suit on the street and have to go after someone else. And it's not about that. The drill is about us being able, or the handlers being able to say, hey, it's not who you think it is. You think it's that guy over there. Now I need to switch your focus and let you know it's this guy over here. And I think that is a very simple drill, but the dogs that I've shown it to have had very hard times dealing with that.
We do something.
That's going to be a tough time with that bite suit.
We dumb that down a little bit. We'll take the suit and we'll set it up and make sure that it is, as the dog is about to be deployed, that it's clearly visible, that it's the thing that is the central focus as the dog is about to breach the doorway. And then off to the side, we'll have a guy sitting in a chair passively. And every dog is going to go, I expect it, every dog is going to go nail that bite suit. But what I'm looking for is the dog to go, oh, this is nothing, and then leave and then go find the actual person. Some dogs get pretty hung up on that, and they'll stay engaged with that suit for a while. They'll figure it out.
Here at Working Dog Depot, we're pleased to make an extra special announcement. Fox and Hound Canine Foundation will be hosting their first celebration event with a fun-filled day meeting canine teams from across the country in an incredible atmosphere on Table Rock Lake in Branson, Missouri. On June 3rd, fun for the whole family will start at 12 noon. Included in the day of events are special canine demonstrations, raffles, a silent auction, vendor booths, balloon artists, live entertainment, and music. Later on in the evening, you're invited and encouraged to join in the gala event starting at 6. You can purchase an entire table or individual seating as you see fit. Enjoy an open bar, which will transition into a cash bar a little bit later in the evening. Also included are a silent auction, music, special private canine demonstrations, and VIP guest appearances. A detailed agenda will be forthcoming as the event date draws closer. We know that the folks at Fox and Hound, our title sponsor, have a huge heart for canines and their handlers. It's important to know that all proceeds that are raised by their fantastic Canine Foundation event go to assist canine teams by providing funding, equipment, supplies, paid canine medical expenses, canine handler education, and specialty training for active and retired canines. Don't miss out on this super opportunity to network, have some fun, and support a wonderful cause. We hope to see you there.
Yeah, and I think that this can almost circle back to that information overload that we talked about. If it's a really young green handler and they see their dog kind of do that in an exercise, like they could take that information in and be like, oh my gosh, my dog is not good. He's not doing what he's supposed to do. And now what am I need to solve this problem here. This trainer says that I need to do this. And that trainer says I need to do this. When in the grand scheme of things, the vast majority of dogs will fail that exercise or quote unquote fail that exercise. Right. So
which isn't a failure, by the way.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that suit has brought them great satisfaction in the past.
Absolutely.
And they're going to gravitate toward it. I mean, we set it up so it's foremost, it's just right there in the frame, and I kind of expect them to go hit it. I haven't seen one yet. It'll just go, that's nothing.
Their reinforcement history is all about that, right? It's all been there. Even the dogs that have, you know, engagements, it's still, that's what they've been built on. They know that more better than they know a lot of things. So
I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
I was telling Rich about this. I'll tell this story real quick. I won't try to drag it out. But we had a situation that it was probably the fact that there were multiple people in the room that saved our butts. But there was a dog that we were working. We had a guy up in a really high cabinet in a building next door to the one we were in. And we had a door propped open into the building that where we were, about five of us were sitting and chatting. And the handler and the decoy were in the next building over, completely detached. Nothing connects the two buildings. And we're sitting there talking. And next thing we know, this dog that has been deployed next door comes in the room, tails up like a scorpion, hackles on his back all the way up. He makes one lap around the room to each of us, kind of like, is it you? Is it you? Is it you? Leaves the room. He's already passed another guy in the hallway twice. Comes back in the room a second time, and he's still just really jacked up. This time, the guy that was in the hall managed to get his to come back in. And when the dog goes out the second time, he closes the door. we all knew that we were, you know, and I had a bite suit literally laying at my feet. And I, after he left the first time, I thought, do I make a move for it? Do I put it on? Or are we just going to ride this out? And we rode it out. But I really honestly believe that one is that, the you know, the last thing the dog had been tasked with is really to go bite somebody. But I think the fact that he came in the room and there are basically five people that are sitting there passively, not running. Had there been just one of us standing, we'd have been toast.
Yeah.
I know for certain. And I think that it was just a picture that dog hadn't seen. And this is a dog that's had multiple apprehensions on the road. So we just kind of puckered and waited for it. So that one of the guys ran over to me. It was hairy. It was one of the hairiest things I've experienced in a while, but funny stuff. You never know what's going to happen. So this dog managed to push a door open on the building next door, negotiate probably 75 to 100 yards to the building where to the door, the building we were in, forced his way through a small opening in the door, went down the hall, made a left, made a right into the room where we were. Pretty slick stuff.
And thank you anybody outside when he was making that negotiation.
Places in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Oh.
Just say it happened in a neighborhood in Mexico. It wasn't in America.
Yeah, this story is completely fallacy.
Hypothetical.
Yeah, it's a hypothetical situation for sure.
Oh my goodness. Oh.
Yeah. I think, man, like these dogs are pretty smart. We're capable of using them for a lot of things. One thing that I try and make sure is out there as much as possible is that the vast majority of times that dog, even our bite dogs are used, they result in an arrest without a bite occurring, right? And even when a bite occurs, a lot of times it's a dog bite instead of someone, you know, receiving use of lethal force. So they're out there saving lives, you know, handlers' lives, backup officers' lives. But I also think that they're even the criminal element at these times, the dogs are actually saving them from sometimes the choices that they make. And just having the presence of a dog, when I go to these seminars, I try and tell guys, because a lot of times people can get caught up and, well, this dog hasn't had his first bite yet. Okay, well, how many arrests has he been involved in? He'd be like, well, 40 arrests. So it's like, well, sounds like he's doing a pretty good job. Like, you know, 40 arrests that have happened because he's there, or we've been able to collect evidence that has been pivotal in a case, or recover, you know, missing people, or all of these things. I was like, man, they're so such a valuable tool. And yeah, of course, you know, when it comes to it and it's necessary for them to get out there and apprehend someone, they definitely need to be able to do that. But there's so much more than just teeth and a jaw, you know.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Primarily a location tool, but and I agree. I don't think that biting people should be a measure of success. Certainly many, many other things that they're exceptionally good at. And we have one agency that does a watch commander report after every shift. And to me, that's just invaluable information. And some of the coolest stuff that I'll find out that happened last night or happened tonight. And it's good stuff.
Yeah. So we hear it all the time, man. You know, the SWAT team's got a house surrounded and they're been making their announcements and trying to negotiate or whatever. The dog comes out and they make some canine announcements, and then suspect comes out with their hands up, you know, like can't go smoother than that, man. That's affecting an arrest to me, invaluable.
That's a win all the way around. That's right.
Yeah.
Very cool.
All right. Well, we don't want to take up any more of your evening. Really do appreciate you coming on.
I know that's not a problem. I'm thank you guys for having me on, and it's always a pleasure to chat with you guys. And like I said, I don't know if I said it on air or while we've been recording, but I'm really a fan of what you guys are doing here and bringing in and having these conversations with people, man. It's, you know, invaluable information that you're sharing to the masses, and thank you guys for that.
Well, thank you. This was Rich's brainchild. And it, you know, we've said it many times. It took us 2 years to make this thing happen. We did about 6 episodes under a different format, and we basically bagged it because it was just, I mean, they weren't bad. We had some cool interviews. We interviewed Tom Davis, and we had some really good guests, and we just couldn't get it going.
Yeah. Well, you're here now.
That's right. It took a bit, but you know, we're happy that it's moving in the direction it's moving. And thank you so much for coming on. We do appreciate it, man. Thank you for your time, and thank you for information, and thank you for what you do. Keep putting out that great content, and hopefully people, you know, if they don't know who you are, hopefully they'll reach out and find out who you are and see what you're doing up there. And it's some really cool things, man. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Again, thank you guys for having me, and I'll see you guys at a Hold the Line conference.
All right. Hey, what a great guest. Super nice guy. Really enjoyed having Michael on the show. Pretty cool to hang out with as well.
Yes, he's definitely one of the good guys. I've really enjoyed listening to his content, watching his videos. Good stuff.
Yeah, if you haven't gone over and followed him and looked at some of his videos, he puts out some really good information. He really does.
Yes. So tonight we are sampling Jefferson's Reserve. And I did a little research before I came upstairs to do this, and it said very old on the bottle. So I thought, what is that? So very old to Jefferson's is a 20-year-old.
Okay. Old bourbon. That is an old bourbon. Nice. So Jefferson's Reserve, very old, very in a very small batch, 20-year-old, I guess.
Yes. Very small batch. I don't know what that is, but it says.
Jefferson's Ocean is one of my favorites, and maybe we'll do that next time.
Okay. If I can find it. I was looking at the website. It has Voyages, O-Search. So, yeah, there is a ocean theme.
Yeah. Oh, it's a cool story. Jefferson's is a cool bourbon. Very tasty. So, sir, here's to the hair of the dog that bit you.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, it doesn't suck. Pretty tasty. Thanks so much, you guys, for following along, supporting us, and listening to these wonderful conversations that Howard and I are just blessed to have each and every day. We'd like to thank and support all of our first responders, police, fire, EMS, and our military for once again holding the line, keeping us safe. Stay safe, brothers and sisters. We love you. God bless, and God bless America.